Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. I am super grateful for the messages and phone calls I've gotten from the people that know me or don't know me. It means a lot. I'm trying to learn to accept love like the rest of us and feel like I deserve it. You know, it's a work. It's a work in progress. And, man, I am picking up a Minnesota accent, Patrick. I don't know if you're hearing it, but I'm starting to, like, I sell scones at my job. I'm like, oh, do you want a scone? The scones are delicious. And so,
pandering, Dave, you're pandering.
I'm not pandering. I pick up accents. People wonder where my accent comes from. They're like, you have a very interesting way of talking. It's because I got St. Louis, Portland, Minnesota, Iowa, L.A. all going on in there. But, so Patrick and I were just talking about the format. I mean, I don't know. I kind of feel like Patrick maybe cuts out some of this stuff of me talking about the podcast and, like, how to podcast and where we're at. But, you know, I mean, that's just, like, the process that we work with. I mean, I lay down some words and he makes some cuts and we move on to the next one, you know? I mean, that's just kind of how you gotta do it. We have our baby and then we send her or him off into the world, you know? And so, you know, kind of working on the format, it was really great to have an interview with Jenny Jones. She's obviously amazing, and I think we got some more interviews to come, and, like, they'll kind of live in their own universe. And granted, Jenny interviewed me, which I think is cool, and I do want my guests to have control, but maybe I'll interview someone, too. I mean, I finally got internet again. I haven't had internet for a year and a half, and if you're wondering what I did first thing on the internet after not having it, for a year and a half, as I watched Earl Morris documentaries. Earl Morris is my favorite filmmaker. He will come up in the LA story. There's an Earl Morris theme in there, you know? And he's great at interviews. And ironically, Earl Morris's key to interviews is that he... Do you know this, Patrick? He doesn't ask an opening question. You know, so he just sits there and looks at the person, and they say what they're going to say. If you want to see some great Earl Morris documentaries, there used to be a website called Grantland. He did 4 or 5 sports documentaries. And these are documentaries that you definitely do not have to be a sports fan to enjoy. Maybe even better if you're not a sports fan. But he kind of opens the window to not asking a question. And he interviews one of them. Maybe my favorite one is about the world's most successful streaker. Right? And so this guy sits down who's, he streaked everything, Patrick. He streaked the Super Bowl, the Westminster Dog Show, the Olympics. Like, he is the Jim Thorpe of streaking. He is the Bob Dylan of showing his dick to the public. And he looks at Earl Morris having like a staring contest and he's like, what's your first question? He's like, I don't have a first question. What's your first answer? And the guy goes, I live for fun. You know? And then that's like the thing. Then that's what the documentary is going to be about. You know, they kind of like reveal that to you. So, you know, maybe I'll do some interviews. I do have some interviewing skills, but it's just got to be the right person. I mean, we're not paying anyone. I'm not famous. Anyways, it's got to be the right individual. But after listening to me and Jenny Jones talk, now I do kind of want to interview Jenny Jones. I've got additional questions. So that's kind of where we are with the podcast. And then I think the next part of like the format that we're working out is some general observations about the world. And I was meaning to talk about this previously, but there's a kind of a misconception about artists, performers, etc., that I think is kind of intentionally hidden from the general public, but like, say you're a person who's a big fan of music and you go see a band, right? You go to see a band, maybe it's not like a stadium show, right? But a large venue, and there's a band that opens for that band. The people in that band are financially struggling. They probably don't have health insurance. They're in rough shape. Like, when you see the opening comedian before the comedian that you like, that comedian has a rich spouse, the opener. If they don't have a rich spouse, they can't do that job. Someone's got to be paying the bills for them. You know, I know, I don't know a lot of famous people, but I know a lot of working professionals, and a lot of those working professionals that I know, you'll find out, like, oh, I went to Harvard, I went to Yale, I went to Stanford, you know, I grew up in Nantucket. And the kind of consensus, I mean, there's some jokes in 30 Rock, if you ever saw that show, about their comedy writers being super well educated. And the thing is, them being smart, that's just a part of it. I mean, granted, people who go to these fancy schools are often smart, you know. I know one of the things I like about Patrick is he doesn't like Malcolm Gladwell. And I like that he's so. He thinks he's kind of a snake oil salesman is what he always says. And I just appreciate Patrick's hot librarian takes. And but Malcolm Gladwell says that these schools are like modeling agencies, right? That it's not so much that they make you smart, but they're just a collection of super smart people. So, yes, I have friends who went to Harvard. They are smart. But the reason that they are professional comedians, more than that, because I also have a friend who is incredibly smart and was a professional comedian for a long time, who did not go to college at all, definitely had a very substandard public education, it's that they have the money to make it as a comedian, that they can ride that roller coaster of open mics and unpaid internships and shitty writing jobs, that there's this like elite that's in comedy because they can afford to get there. And so no one is getting paid, right? No one's getting paid. And I mean, for those of you that know me and have seen my previous projects, know that there is a live Dave Good show that I have worked on in the past and will always continue to work on. And I want to bring people together for some kind of a festival. And I want to pay them. You know, I don't know exactly what my fundraising strategy is, but like, the artists that you love are not getting paid. And there's this bullshit out there that's like, oh yeah, that's because they're shitty artists, that they haven't made it yet, and that if, you know, if they were good, they would get paid. Fuck no, that's not true. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of fantastic artists who, after not getting paid, were like, fuck it, I'm going to be a real estate agent, I'm going to get my PhD and whatever, I'm going to just do something else, and they quit and they do something else because there's no money in it, right? I don't know. Patrick, have you read the book Freakonomics? Mm-hmm. Right? Freakonomics breaks down the economics of Hollywood, right? Of being an actor in Hollywood, and compares that to being a crack dealer in Chicago, right? And the thing is, both of these, the only people making money are at the top, right? The crack dealers in, I think it's Chicago, wherever the crack dealers are making less than minimum wage, right? With the hope of one day making the big bucks, you know? Actors are making whatever, $62 to be a fake audience member on The Price is Right. You know, they're making this terrible money, and with the hopes of making it big. And what this structure is known as is a tournament, right? It's a tournament structure. And so that means that you can be the best and not win. That's what people have difficulty understanding, that you can nail all your auditions, you can write all your songs perfectly, and still not quote-unquote make it. And so This is a uniquely American phenomenon, right? Because that's the culture that we're living in right now. This zero-sum game of winners and losers. And I have a friend who is a poet. He lives in Paris. And one time I said, hey, why do you live in Paris? And he said, because I can be a poet in Paris. I can't be a fucking poet in Brooklyn. There's no money for poetry in Brooklyn. And our American culture does not value the arts. And what the fuck? We're so rich. Fucking chill out, America. Toss some money to your artists. Think about the things that we could have, how beautiful our world could be. Our music could be better. Our art could be better. Everything could be so much better. And so people are not getting paid. You know, people are not getting paid. My situation of working a full-time job while doing this restaurant is just that, you know, go, when you're at Coachella or, you know, I'm saying if you're one of those people who has disposable income, you know, and you're like, oh man, oh my God, I want to be a rock star so bad. Think about your health insurance and how much you like it. Think about your car, your garage, your et cetera, because artists do not get paid. You know, they do not get paid, and it's super sad. And it's this, Patrick used the phrase earlier, devil's bargain. It's like, what do you want to do? Not make your music? Well, for some people, like for me, not telling stories feels like fucking drowning. You know, when I am not doing a project, I have difficulty understanding why life has meaning, you know, and you're just born this way, you know? I mean, all I would want, I went to a show last night. I hadn't been to a show just for fun in a long time, though I did know the band. I still never go if I don't know the band. And we were just talking about the gray area. Like, I wish, a part of me, like, it was like, oh, I wish I did the first podcast and people, like, no one listened to it and no one said it was good. And people were like, hey, Dave, come to your senses. You need to do something else. There's like a freedom in that, you know? Bullets Over Broadway. You ever seen that movie, Bullets Over Broadway?
Don't speak. I have.
My God, I love Bullets Over Broadway. Great movie about the creative process. And I think the last line of that movie is, I'm not an artist and I am free, right? That's what Cusack says at the end, because he realizes that he's a shitty writer and how great that would be. But like this band that I saw last night called Black Sam Malone, they were good. I'm like, we're in the fucking gray area. This sucks, you know, you get in the gray area. We're like, yeah, you're good. You're not making money, but you're good. And people like you. And, you know, and so, you know, that's just that's the state of affairs. I think I figured it out one time. I believe the amount of our tax dollars that go to the arts is about a nickel, right? That's what we give to the arts as Americans. That's what Americans think about art. They think it is worth one nickel per year. I live in the Twin Cities, which is the most highly funded arts community in America. So here, the people in the Twin Cities think it's worth $5, okay? They're willing to pay $5 a year for their art. I mean, just think about a world where we paid $100 a year for our art. I don't know what 100 divided by a nickel is. But it's a lot. It's a lot. We could have a greatly more beautiful world if we weren't such cheap and evil bastards who just, God forbid, you give an artist a dollar he didn't deserve. What the fuck is she going to do with that dollar? She's just going to paint a painting, not going to produce anything. What's that painting going to do for the fucking stock market, you know? What's the Dow going to do if we have people just making paintings? Oh, God forbid all these young black men would be forming bands and, you know, I mean, So, anyways, that's the state of the arts in America. It's totally shit and it needs to be discussed more. I just hate that we call ourselves the greatest country in the world, not when it comes to the arts. You know? So, anyways, There we go. There's some soapbox observations. I'm good at righteous indignation. It's a part of my skill set. And then, of course, we got to continue the story serial style, you know, because that's what, that is the art form that people respond to well, is stories that have cliffhangers and you want to know what's happening next. And so I'm on my way to LA. I believe I was talking about staying at a hotel in Blue Earth, Minnesota, and eating the beef jerky that Patrick gave me for emergency's sake, and being at emergency beef jerky level already, like 5 hours in. I also know that I had a bunch of like pots and pans. It's so funny, when you move, you think you need all this stuff, and then 5 hours down the road, you don't need as much as you thought you need. I mean, I had all my typical pots and pans from Goodwill, and they were just taking up so much space in my Integra. I mean, it was like all I had was the driver's side seat of the Integra and enough room to see out the side rearview mirrors. And so I took all these pots and pans and just filled up a trash can outside the hotel with like pots and pans and random home goods. Sorry to the person who had to take out that trash. And this hotel I was staying at was very cheap. And I had this thought, you know, Dave, just get 3 more days at this hotel. I think it was like $39. It was super clean. Sorry, this is after Blue Earth. I stopped in South Dakota was my next stop because there was bad weather. And I left in November. I was just like, the bad weather was chasing me. And I love South Dakota. Great, great state for basketball. Great state for Native American rights. Underrated state, South Dakota. Beautiful. And I just this thought I should stay for like a couple more days, but you know me and my schedules. I had this whole plan that I wanted to spend a week in Vegas and grind out as much cash as I could before I got to LA, and I wanted to be in LA on this specific date, and I hit the road after one day, you know, and drove. I got to the desert when the first wrong thing happened in my car. Like the first time like a weird chunky noise made it. I believe what happened is a hole rusted out in the muffler because I had driven through all this salt. And so suddenly my car got super loud. And now I'm in the desert. It's like 85 degrees, all the sun. I'm super pale. And I'm just like, fuck, if my car breaks down in the desert, do I have sunscreen? Where in this super stacked car is my sunscreen? And so suddenly now I'm in, this is like, it's a fucking Oregon Trail. I'm driving through the desert in a broken down Integra. But I make it and I get to LA, right? And this is my third time in LA. And this is, every other time I had always flown there and then stayed on the strip so I didn't have to get a car or take any cabs. That was how I would save cash. And I would walk. And let me tell you, walking in Vegas is far. Those casinos are so big. They don't seem big when you're in a cab or in a plane. But man, when you walk, you know, always the cheapest hotel on the strip, Patrick, is the Hooters Casino. Because it's super shitty and no one wants to stay there. So like walking from the Hooters Casino to, at the time, Treasure Island, which was the poker room that had the best artwork and the coolest dealers, was like, I don't know, 50 minutes. It was like a 50-minute walk. You know, good 2-3 miles to that casino and back. So this time I have a car and I'm going to stay in North Vegas. I'm going to stay in the cheapest hotel I can get because that's, you know, people think poker's so fun. I mean, poker is just American capitalism boiled down into a game. You know, you got to minimize your expenses. And so I'm staying at Howard Johnson's in North Vegas. And I get there. My car full of stuff makes it. I park and I cannot believe it. There is a line out the door of this hotel. A fucking line out the door. And I'm waiting in the line and all the people in the line are very, how can I say this delicately? Very rural, very white and rural, you know? Very, there's this David Cross joke, like a low understanding of the irony of their t-shirts, like American-made t-shirt, you know? And like, I'm someone who's definitely not a healthy person, but something's going on in this line. And I'm like, hey, what is going on in this line? And they're like, oh, we're out here for a motorcycle race. And I'm like, wait, say that again. You're here for what? And they're like, we're here for a motorcycle race. And I say, you mean the race from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas? The motorcycle race that Hunter S. Thompson went to cover? And they're like, yes. And I'm like, this shit is happening, right? I'm going to be fucking telling this story someday because I'm in the fucking Hunter S. Thompson. So I check in the hotel, like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It's like incredible. And it occurs to me that I do have something stashed away in my car. And that thing is hash, right? I have some hash. And so it's like, hey, I'm staying at the Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas hotel. I gotta smoke some hash before I go to my first night in Las Vegas, you know? And so I have a plan. I mean, obviously the best place to smoke hash is always in a parking lot. And so I drive to Vegas, and as I'm approaching Vegas, I realize it's Friday night. I realize I've never been to Vegas on a weekend before. Every time I've previously gone to Vegas, I'm always getting the cheapest plane ticket. It was like Tuesday. And, you know, I'm going in the off months, so the hotel rooms are as cheap as they can possibly be. But no, not this time. It's prime time Las Vegas. And I get there, and holy shit, there is nowhere to park. Like, every other time I'd park at the first casino and walk in, I drive through parking lots for like 40 minutes. Like, a parking lot after parking lot after parking lot. Finally, I get to Caesar's Palace, and I'm at the very top level. I find a parking spot. And so I discreetly smoke as much hash in my car as quickly as I can, you know? And I mean, in general, I have a high tolerance for THC, but I had been living cheap to make this trip happen. And so it had been a while since I had had any. And I smoke a lot of hash, and then I head down and I walk onto the floor at Caesar's Palace, and oh my god, I was not ready for that level of sensory overload. I mean, I appreciated Fear and Loathing and on a whole other level. I cannot imagine what it would be like to be on LSD in Las Vegas. I am high as fuck. There are people everywhere, lights everywhere. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to Treasure Island, my favorite poker room. That's my plan. And you know how they design casinos to keep you in the casino, right? I can't find my way out. Like, I keep walking this loop in these circles and I can't get out of Caesar's Palace. And like, I'm so high that I'm starting to panic. And every time I do a loop, it's just getting louder. You know, the people are turning into fucking bloodthirsty dinosaurs in front of my face. I cannot make it out of Caesar's Palace. And so, I don't know what happens. I just see this sign and it says exit. And I just make a beeline. I just like panic and I just go down this hallway. And the thing is, it's not a nice hallway. I'm not supposed to be in this hallway. And I open the door, it opens, and I walk out behind the casinos, right? A place that you should never get to. Like, I managed to get so lost that I go out some crazy corridor, and now I'm behind the strip, behind the fucking curtain. And there are no sidewalks, and there's these giant-ass trucks, like, delivering, like, the huge amounts of food and drink and beverages to, like, keep this beast going. And so I just start walking down the road. Like, there's no sidewalk. These cars are rushing past me. I don't know what the fuck is going on. Finally, I see some steps, and I run up the steps, and there's a security guard standing there. Just like classic Vegas security guard, woman, stringy hair, smoking a cigarette, wise eyes, and she just goes, "What the hell are you doing here, man?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I got lost in Caesar's Palace. I couldn't find my way out, and I came here." And she's like, "Oh, sweetie, these places are so confusing. I totally understand." And she's like, "So here's how you get back." And she starts okay, you got to go down these stairs, and you got to go this way, and then you got to go this way, and this way. And she sees like the look on my face as she's giving me this incredibly complicated list of directions to get back to regular casino town. And she's like, okay, new plan. Here's what you do. You're going to go through this door. You're going to take two lefts, two rights, and then a left. And then you're going to come out onto the floor. You're going to go down the escalator, and then you're going to go outside, right? And she says, if anyone sees you in those hallways, you just run, right? So again, blown out of my mind on hash, I go into the back corners of the fucking, oh my God, the back corners of the fucking casino, whatever, two lefts, three rights, fucking come outside, go down the escalators, come out of the escalators, and it is the, I'm right by the volcano in front of the Mirage, and it explodes. Explodes in fire. And it explodes in fire. And that's the thing, is there's some higher significance to this. I mean, obviously I'm on a mystical agnostic journey and I see a higher significance, but poker players have this superstition. I mean, poker players have a lot of superstitions. But one of the most common is, what is your trip to the poker room like? You know? Like, it's true. Like, when I would play in Minnesota, I think I left this out of the story. I did win the No Limit Hold'em tournament on the way out of town in Minnesota. But, like, how many green lights are on the way? If it's all green lights, you feel like it's going to go well. If there's construction in your way, it feels like it's not going to go well. So after this trip to the casino, I was like, what the fuck is going to happen? And I knew that this journey of getting lost in Caesars and going out the back and then down all these secret corridors and then to the exploding volcano was not just about this night of poker. This was the prophecy of my trip to LA. That shit was going to be more complicated than I possibly could imagine. That shit was going to explode. And so the volcano explodes. There's people everywhere, just fucking everywhere, you know. I finally make it to the casino and I start to grind, you know. I start to try to grind out some cash and, you know, the cards aren't super kind. You know, I do fine. I pay for my time in Vegas. You know, my bankroll goes from 700 to 200 to 900 to 400 to, you know, blah, blah, blah. The typical road of the poker, you know. But it'd be funny, I'd be sitting at this poker table and people will be like, well, where do you live? Where are you from? You know? And I'm like, well, I used to live in Minnesota and I'm gonna live in Los Angeles. But right now I live right here at this poker table with you. So, yeah. And there was this one other moment this time in Vegas where I'm like walking down a hallway. Actually, I ran into an ex-girlfriend who I still kind of love when I was in Las Vegas. That was like a whole thing too. And as I was contemplating, she had a boyfriend, but I saw her again, you know, and it was intense. And so I just was wandering Las Vegas like I like to do. And I was going through this mall and there was no one in this mall. And then there was a sports memorabilia store, right? No one in the sports memorabilia store except the person in there signing autographs. And it was Pete Rose. So I had this fucked up mall interaction of just like standing there alone, looking at Pete Rose just by himself, staring off into the distance, you know, being like, hey, can I please sell you 7 autographs so I can get back to the fucking craps table or whatever the hell Pete Rose was up to. So, yeah, I mean, my grandpa was a Vegas guy. He was a poker dealer. He's the guy who taught me to help tell stories. That's like the rhythm, the unique rhythm of my voice. It does come directly from Vegas, you know. GT taught me how to talk. His stories were incredible. So I leave Las Vegas and I head to LA, you know. And I had so many plans, backup plans. I'm a planner. I'm not like super organized in my daily life. Like my apartment's a mess and I just make lists. I like don't have like a planner, but long-term big picture planning, I'm very meticulous about. And I believe I had 4 places that I was going to stay I was going to stay temporarily in the shack in Topanga that I stayed at previously when I was in LA. And then I had like a couple people who I thought had an apartment for me to rent. I had a couch to crash in if I needed to. So those were like my four places. And like as I'm driving to LA, it's like, hey, decided to move. No longer have a couch for you to crash on. Hey, decided to move. Nowhere for you to stay. Hey, decided to move. Because it's LA. Because one day people are just done and they just go. So on my way there, I lost all of the places that I had to stay. And I'm driving to this shack in Topanga. And as soon as I get to the top and park, I shit you not, the transmission in my car fucking drops. Like, it stops running when I get there. And like suddenly my paradise in Topanga is not a paradise. Now I'm like fucking Nicholson in The Shining, fucking trapped in this thing. I got no idea what I'm gonna do with my car, you know? And then like right away it's sinking in like how, oh shit, the last time I was here, because I had my friend Dan who was in Topanga. Last time I was here, I had a fucking premium rental car and I was working at a fancy ass art fair. And now I'm like, hey man, can you pick me up and take me to get some food? Like, you know, like right away I'm asking for a favor, and it's not, hey, I'm a big shot favor. It's like, oh, hey, by the way, I'm totally fucked. Day one, I don't have a car. I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do, you know? And my friend is kind of now suspicious of, am I for real or not? Because everyone is full of shit, you know, in general. I want to say everyone's full of shit in Los Angeles, but I mean, I just went to a hipster rock show in Minneapolis last night. People are full of shit a lot of places. Last night I had somebody tell me about like trying to get on a reality television show and then tell me that they thought LA was super shallow. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, you just told me you're trying to get on a reality television show. So my transmission is fucked. You know, I buy a bunch of food. I'm making it with like a toaster oven and a wood burning stove, trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And I got to get my car towed somewhere, you know. And I call the tow truck guy and he shows up and he's Russian, right? And he's like, what the fuck is going on here? I got, you know, Minnesota plates, a stud car, etc. I'm like, the transmission dropped. And he like, and I had been Googling, that's the thing about this shack in the mountains, is it had Wi-Fi, like how much it was for a new transmission. And it was supposed to be about $2,200, right? Which is like all of my money. I mean, not like all of it, but $2,200 when I'm moving. It's insane. And he like looks at me and he's like, you know what? I will put a new transmission in your car for $1,400. I will do that for you. And I'm like, seriously? He's like, yeah, you just give me your car and then I will put the new transmission and then I will meet you at McDonald's and you will give me $1,400 in cash and then I will give you a fixed car, you know? And I'm like, fuck, I don't know if I should do this or not, you know? And he's like, you know, in life, you must trust. You must trust. You must trust. And I'm like, okay, dude, fucking put a transmission in my car, you know? And sure enough, 4 days later, he fucking rolls in with my car fixed. I give the man $1,400 and he gives me a fixed car, you know? So, I mean, not to get on a fucking political soapbox here, but go easy on the Russians, people. Everyone talking shit about the fucking Russians all the time. A Russian man in LA fucking helped me out big time. Complain about the Russian oligarchy, please. Like, get your fucking words right. Complain about the gangsters that run the country. Don't paint them all with one brush. This fucking Russian ex-professional soccer player turned part-time mechanic in LA. Fucking help me out. So he gives me a car, gives me my car back. And now it's like, where the fuck am I gonna stay? You know? And so I get on Airbnb, which Airbnb, man, it's great if you want to stay somewhere 2 days, but if you want to stay somewhere for a month, people are like, wait, I don't want you to stay in my house for a month, you know? Like, I'm trying to get a month somewhere, and I finally do, I get this, you know, like I said, so many plans of so many places to stay that I wanted to stay. I really didn't want to stay in Koreatown because it's super dense and urban, you know, but here I am, renting a place for a month. I think it was $1,100, which is absurdly cheap given the circumstances. To stay for a month in Koreatown, you know? And it was kind of amazing. This guy was a ballet dancer. So like after all the ballets and stuff that I worked for, here I'm in this ballet dancer's apartment. You know, I don't know how long I've been there, 2-3 weeks. But I mean, again, I had had this list of contacts, you know, all these people I had met working all these shows, you know, big time people, musicians, people at museums, etc. No one had anything for me. Like, no one had a lead on a place to stay. No one had a lead on a job. I'd never had so many leads crap out, you know, but it's another thing about LA. Everybody wants you to think they're killing it, you know? Like, I have this joke, like, anytime somebody comes home from New York or LA to the Midwest, they immediately dress like they've been really successful in LA or New York. Like, they show up at home, they got the fucking slick shit on, they got stories to tell about the amazing things that they've done, but in reality, they're fucking eating mac and cheese and wondering where it all went wrong, you know? It's a facade, and so I go up to the roof to have a cigarette, you know, and man, I need to hit my Juul. I want this show to get sponsored by Highball Energy Drinks and Juul. You know, I'm trying to be empathetic and sensitive about all things, and I am kind of wired anti-capitalist, but you know, look, Highball Energy Drinks and Juul, if you want to give me some money, I'll talk good about your products. I love them genuinely, you know. Highball, it's like Adderall Light, you know. It's ADD med if you don't want to be a fucking sociopath. So I go up to the roof of this place and I meet the ubiquitous police helicopters of Los Angeles, you know. Every night, they just... You get used to it after living there, but when you first get there, it is crazy that there's all these helicopters with spotlights flying around, and I'm looking at these fucking helicopters and smoking my cigarette. And that's the first time it ever occurred to me, like, what if this doesn't work? You know, what if this doesn't work? What if I immediately crash and burn? What if I just lose all of my money right off the top? Don't find a place to stay. I had no plan. I had no plan for it not working. Because, I mean, I'm fucking Dave Good. I got nothing but mojo, you know? I got nothing but mojo. I work my ass off. I'm from the Midwest. This is supposed to work. Man, now I got really fucking depressed. And I'm like, what am I going to do if this does not work? And I, you know, like somewhere from above had two thoughts, you know. One is that Dave, everyone deserves love. And if this doesn't work, you're going to keep looking for a girlfriend. That's what you're going to do, you know. Because even you of the busted car and the not enough money and the no connections that work out, you deserve love. And number two, no matter what, I'll always keep doing the Dave Good Show. You know, I was like, it doesn't matter if this doesn't work. I'll keep doing the fucking Dave Good Show, you know? And so I went inside. I made myself a tea with some soy eggnog, a treat I really enjoy, and I fucking fired up an OkCupid profile, you know? I start internet dating, right? And this is nuts. Hey, I'm super creative. I have a podcast. I came here to make it, you know? And everyone's like, yeah, whatever. I've heard that 1,000 times today, you know? And it's like, what? internet dating in Minnesota. I'm the only one. I just started internet dating in Minnesota again. And they're like, what? You work on a podcast? You do hospitality for famous people? What the fuck? You know? You're supposed to tell me you're a healthcare consultant for Mayo Clinics, or, you know, like, you're supposed to be a thing. So immediately, like, I'm a cliche, and I mean, just the rules are fucking different, you know? They're fucking different, but, you know, I'm trying to go on dates. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And the thing is, now it's like LA, you visit LA, and it's amazing. But when you get there and you sit down in it, it looks like sprawl, right? It looks like sprawl. But it's far denser than people realize because of the scale. It's just like when you're in Vegas and you're walking, you don't realize how big those casinos are. When you're in LA, you don't realize how big the apartment buildings are. You know, so an apartment building, a stretch of blocks of apartment buildings in Minnesota, they're 4 stories tall and 8 apartments wide. In LA, they're 8 stories tall and 16 apartments wide, you know? The density is nuts. So, like, what the fuck am I going to do? Now I have no contacts. I'm fucking, it's like LA just, like, took a fucking canister of gasoline, poured it on my cash, and lit a match, you know? I do not know what the fuck I'm going to do. And I'm like, well, I guess I'll just go for a walk, you know? You got to start somewhere. So I head out of my apartment and I, you know, I can go any direction, right? I'm like, I'm just going to pick a direction and I'm going to start walking. Man, if I would have gone one way, I would have gone to like a really nice part of town. If I got another way, I'd have gone to Beverly Hills, you know? But I went left and I went to MacArthur Park. Right? I don't know if you've heard of MacArthur Park.
You know the song. I know the famous song.
Is there a famous song about MacArthur Park?
There is. Sung by, is it Richard Harris?
Oh, okay.
In the late 60s.
But oh, yeah.
I'll let you continue your
no,
story.
No, I figured that it was like MacArthur Park. Like,
I'm not sure if it's the same.
MacArthur I figured you heard Park. It in like a Tupac song.
No. But I'll let you.
So I walk through this park, like, it's not a park that generally, like, you know, whatever, white Midwestern dudes are walking through, you know. I walk through that park, I walk to a street called Alvarado, and I start walking through this, like, totally Latino neighborhood, right? And I need to clarify, because LA has got all these different ethnic neighborhoods, but also ethnic neighborhoods of different socioeconomic classes, right? I mean, that's how vast it is. It's like these things where, you know, in a smaller city, there's just a couple versions of different ethnic communities. In LA, there's every possible version of every possible ethnic community. And I'm just walking down the street of like tiny stores and everybody's speaking Spanish. No one is speaking English at all. And this like small child walks out and points at me and she goes, Estrella, Estrella. Estrella, you know, which is like, there's a star, there's a movie star on the block, you know, and her mom was like, no, Blanco, un Blanco, you know, it's just a white guy. It's just a white guy, but there's this Bill Burr joke, like, I'm so magical that when I'm in a not white, or I'm so white that when I'm in a not white neighborhood, I look magical, like some kind of leprechaun. I think he's talking about Harlem, you know. He's got a great story about having a booty call with a black woman in Harlem. But, like, it's the same thing. Like, so, anyways, that's my first walk, you know. And then so it's just, you're just trying to figure out, like, what is even going on. Like, I had all these intense plans. And then now I'm just on a way more primal level of, like, where the fuck am I? What's going on? Where do I eat? Everywhere is so crowded, you know, trying to get in touch with my friends. It's extreme, you know, it's extreme. And, yeah, okay, I know where I'm going now. So, I have a friend who's like, I can get you a studio apartment in Beverly Hills for $1,000. And I'm like, oh, hell yeah, let's do this, you know? Fucking, I gotta skip over some details because I have to protect the innocent, you know? And I get this apartment, and it's not in Beverly Hills, you know? It's Beverly Hills adjacent. The closest parking space, the closest place I can park is a 45-minute walk away, right? I get into this apartment. No one is picking up the trash, right? Outside the building, there is a, you can see just bits and pieces of a dumpster and then just a massive mountain of trash. And the other thing about this apartment is the reason it was cheap and that someone needed to be taken right away is this person had a pet bunny, a pet rabbit. And I've got a very mystical relationship with rabbits, so I thought this was a good sign. Have we talked about pukas? You know, have we talked about the puka? I mean, so for those of you who don't know what a puka is, it's a Celtic spirit, right? And it generally takes the form of an animal. Excuse me, I believe it's a pre-Celtic spirit, right? Which is, when I learned about it, that's like saying it could come from fucking alien pre-Celtic. That's old. Generally in the form of a rabbit, but it can be other animals. And it's a mischievous spirit, right? And this mischievous spirit, what it does is it fucks with you in a way that helps you, right? Like, it fucks with you, but you end up better on the other side of it. So I get into this apartment, and the rabbit is black. I did not expect it to be black. And it's been living outside of the cage, and there is shit everywhere. Everywhere. I'm in an apartment that is covered in poop. And the back is piles of trash. And I can park, the closest I can park is 45 minutes away. I mean, I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do. Now I've given the rest of my money for this apartment. I'm getting 2-for-1 breakfast sandwiches at McDonald's. I haven't eaten at McDonald's in years. Now it's a fundamental part of my day, and my body's feeling it that I'm ingesting low-level fucking poisons every morning. I don't want McDonald's to be a sponsor of the podcast. You know? Believe me, a Jewel and a highball is way more healthy than a fucking sausage, egg, and cheese McMuffin. And so I start to like scrub the shit. I'm on like my hands and knees scrubbing the shit. Oh, and I go in the bathroom and there's a Hunter S. Thompson quote. It's often attributed to him. And it says, and it's like written, like it almost looks like it's written in blood. Like it's someone trying to do an art project and express what it's like to move to LA. And I can see the entire history of this shitty-ass, trash-covered, poop-covered apartment. And the sign, it says, the television business is a shallow money trench where good men die like dogs and pimps and thieves run free. Right? Which is 100% accurate. So, I'm trying to clean up the poop. You know, all this poop, I'm not good at cleaning. There's supposed to be a bed. There's no bed. There's just a terrible air mattress. There's no internet. I know no one. And I'm now nothing. I mean, I'm 6 weeks in. I have no status. I have no context. I have no anything. But I do continue to internet date. And there is a lady who is very charmed by my shit-covered apartment story. She finds it endearing. I managed to go on a date with her and not be poop-related at all, you know? I go to, like, a favorite bar in K-Town called R-Bar. R-Bar in K-Town. You gotta know a password to get in. And we have a lovely evening together, you know? It's so absurd. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Like, I'm pretending. I was better at pretending then than I am now. I feel like kind of the older you get, the harder it comes to pretend. So I was putting on a front like I thought everything was going to be fine, you know. And hey, I'm not good at everything, but I am good at making out. You know, I've got some makeout skills. And so after this like lovely evening with the lady who's still my friend, I go back, right, to the poop-covered apartment, and I'm like, I gotta get out of here. You know, this is not good. I'm in a terrible spot. The energy here is terrible. And I start looking now for somewhere to go. And I haven't had a roommate in 15 years, and I don't want a roommate, you know, but now I need one. I gotta reduce my living expenses drastically. I gotta buy myself some fucking time, you know, to stabilize. And I see this listing for $750 a month for a bedroom and a house of stand-up comedians. And I think, you know, I had done stand-up a couple times before I did this, but I was like, okay, this sounds good, because comedians aren't going to give me shit, right? If I go stay with some fucking producer from whatever for fucking DreamWorks, like, they're going to be up at 5 every day and work until 7. You know, like, I need cheap rent, and I need to figure out what the fuck is going on with me. And so, and it's a furnished room. So I'm going to get a furnished room and a house of stand-up comedians. I tell the person that gave me the bunny apartment, like, I'm not giving you any money. I mean, I'd given them like a grand as like a deposit, but I'm like, that's all that you're getting is a grand. You know, there was no internet, no bed, and it was covered in shit. Like, that's it, you know. And I go to this house of quote unquote stand-up comedians, right? And we'll talk about this house a lot more in chapter 4, you know, but I want to put this story in a positive place, because I'm so fucked at this moment, but I'm still dating this woman who I met and went to our bar in K-Town with, who is cool, and she's a friend. I mean, it was so nice. She was like, how are things going in LA? And I told her, and she was like, oh my god, that is fucking awful. I am so sorry, you know? And no one had said that. Everyone else is just like, that's LA, blah, blah, blah. You should have planned better. And I'm like, quit telling me I should have fucking planned. I planned for 9 months, you know? And so I'm now gonna drive. This woman has a daughter, right? So that adds another level. I actually never dated anyone with a daughter before. And so that does kind of, you know, there's another person involved, you know. It makes me feel like I need to be an extra bit more responsible. And the Midwestern Protestant ethos in me, like, feeling guilty about being 36 and having roommates and having lost my career direction so rapidly. And I'm driving to see her, and I'm kind of nervous about it. And of course, this is when car problem number 2 happens, right? Where my rusted axle starts to get fucked up. And so now my car is making a weird noise again, and I'm driving to see this girl, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm gonna do now. I've already fixed my car once. I've already gotten one shitty apartment, and now I just moved into this house of comedians, and now my car is dying again, and I start to have like a full-blown panic attack. And I get to her house, which is in West Adams, another Latino neighborhood, multicultural neighborhood. And I'm just sitting in my car, right? Fucking, what am I gonna do? Man, my life has so many moments of me sitting in my fucking car trying to figure out what the fuck am I gonna do? you know? And I'm just giving myself a pep talk. And it's like, Dave, you're going to fucking get your shit together. You're going to go into this apartment. You're going to be the man. And you're going to fuck your girlfriend. That's what you're going to do. That's what you're here for. Be a man. Do your job, you know? But I don't know if I'm buying my pep talk. And it's a two-level apartment. And the second level is a family throwing a quinceañera party, right? For those of you who don't know, a quinceañera, it's kind of like a bar mitzvah, if you know what that is. But if you don't know what either a quinceañera or a bar mitzvah is, then you're too white and Protestant. You need to get your shit together today, okay? Today, read a fucking book, watch a movie with subtitles if you don't know what either a bar mitzvah or a quinceañera is. Anyways, and so I'm walking to go upstairs through this quinceañera, and someone in that party had seen me in my car. They had seen me, and they had read what was going on there, and they could tell. I mean, they must have seen the minute. Maybe they saw the Minnesota plates. I don't know, but they had seen it. And this man, this very tough, hardworking Latino man, comes around the corner with two plates of food. And this is like real food. Food with love in it. Grilled chicken, beans, rice, tortillas, macaroni salad. And he gives me this food. And I looked at him with a face of pure appreciation. I tried to like emote. We're both men here, and I would cry if I could, because this means so much to me. But I will not, because I want you to know that I am tough. And I grabbed those plates and I went upstairs and I thought, you know, maybe I'm supposed to be here after all.
You've been listening to The Dave Good Show.